This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for June 30th, 2014. It was an interesting week. We start with a couple of items that really relate to tax-exempt entities. One, a fraternal group's insurance sales are ruled by the Internal Revenue Service to not produce unrelated business taxable income and not related to its exempt purpose. Then, a company's loan to its employee stock ownership plans turns out to be a prohibited transaction because they did not follow the letter of their adoption agreement. And then final regulations on the waiting period for health insurance, which clarifies a limit on the employment-based orientation period that can allow an employer to exceed the 90-day waiting period. And then an electronic communication in which the IRS Chief Counsel's Office rules that the IRS may assess preparer penalties before a return is examined if the statute of limitations is about to run and the taxpayer refuses to extend the statute. Then Eric Onyanango tried to argue that the IRS had not served him with notice of his deficiency, but the problem was they sent him a certified letter, which he refused to pick up. You can't do that. A tax court decision in which so-called business deductions are disallowed because the court determined that the taxpayers were never engaged in the supposed trades or businesses. Draft instructions for the Form 8938 for 2014 are out, and we have included those, or reference to those, in the citations for this week. And Barbara Kuppersmith was surprised to find that the IRS would not be forced to apply payments from prior years to her current year liability because she had failed to cash the checks. Kind of an interesting take on an old issue. Finally, IRS Commissioner Koskinen announces a voluntary return preparer education program, which would have return preparers who take a continuing professional education and pass an exam to be listed in the IRS National Database of Qualified Return Preparers. And you can imagine certified public accountants and enrolled agents are not real happy about that because there is no clear distinction between the professional qualifications of either group. The feeling being by CPAs and enrolled agents that we have certainly spent a lot more time on our preparation, our education. We've passed a very comprehensive examination, and the voluntary return preparer educated person has probably not. So we'll see how all that works out, and we have a lot to talk about, so let's get started. In Technical Advice Memorandum 2014-25015, the IRS rules that a fraternal beneficiary society's sales of life insurance policies to the widows of its members are unrelated to its tax-exempt purpose. Membership in the society is limited to men of a particular faith who may buy life insurance contracts from the society. After the death of a member, the widow may purchase life insurance from the society within a year after her husband's death. That coverage is not a continuation of the member's policy. The widow may apply for coverage that's different from the coverage her husband had. The insurance products available to the widow are indistinguishable from insurance sold by providers that are subject to federal income tax. And the widow could name as a beneficiary someone who was neither a member of the society nor a dependent of the member. Because those sales of insurance contracts are essentially no different from sales of commercial providers, and the widow can name as a beneficiary someone other than a dependent of her husband, the sales do not contribute importantly to the society's exempt fraternal purpose, as stated, of aiding its members and their dependents. The insurance sales are an unrelated trade or business. Income from that unrelated trade or business will be subject to the unrelated trade or unrelated business tax, and if the unrelated business becomes the predominant activity of the fraternal beneficiary society, they stand to lose their tax exemption as not being primarily engaged in their exempt purpose. Our next technical advice memorandum also relates to a tax-exempt entity. In this case, two employee stock ownership plans sponsored by an employer. In this tech advice, the IRS, following up on an audit finding by the Department of Labor, rules that a loan failed the requirements of exemption from the prohibited transaction rules for loans to employee stock ownership plans by the sponsor and therefore constituted a prohibited transaction. A Labor Department review of the plans found the principal-only method, which is a method of calculating shares for release from an ESOP, rather than the principal and interest method, had been used to calculate the release of shares from 1999 through 2004. The DOL said failure to use the method required by the ESOP pledge agreement constituted a prohibited transaction under ERISA. The DOL went on to subsequently say that even if the principal-only method had been permitted by the plans and pledge agreement, which it was not, by the way, the loan did not meet the statutory requirements needed to allow principal-only payments. Now, here comes the IRS concluding that the loan constituted a prohibited transaction under Section 4975C and that the company is liable for excise taxes, not for the full period 1999 through 2004 because there was a statute of limitations issue. And the IRS also went on to rule that to opine in this technical advice memorandum that the actual interest rather than the prime rate should be used to determine the amount involved and the excise tax. The plan document pledged the plan's shares of the employer's Class A common stock as collateral for a loan from the employer. The pledge agreement also stated that the pledged shares would be released from the suspense account using the principal and interest method. The plan also requires shares to be released using the principal and interest method, or if the requirements of Treasury Regulation 54.4975-7B2i are met, principal payments only. Now, you got to meet, remember, if you're going to make principal payments only, you got to meet the requirements of Regulation Section 54.4975-7B2. Article 4, Section 4.2 of the plan provided that any pledge of financed shares must provide for the release of shares so pledged on a basis equal to the principal and interest paid by the trustee on the acquisition loan. Now, the plan got a favorable determination letter dated June 1st, 2001. Remember, they started this plan July 1st, 1999. That's about par for getting your favorable determination letter. They filed an additional application for a determination letter in 2007, and a 2007 application is pending, but doesn't have a lot to do with this. In 2005, the Department of Labor conducted a review of the plan, found that in operation, the principal-only method, not the principal and interest method, was used to calculate the release of shares from 1999 through 2004. And so the DOL issues it a report. They get a letter to the company. The company agrees to make corrections, and the DOL agrees that they will not press the issue any further. Here's a quote. Because the taxpayer took corrective actions, this office will take no further action on the matter. Okay. And on October the 10th, 2006, the company corrected the deficiencies. Now, here comes the Internal Revenue Service. And they determine that this is a prohibited transaction since they didn't follow the method that they said they were going to follow in their application. And that will be subject to a tax equal to 15% of the amount involved with respect to the prohibited transaction for each year or part thereof. And by the way, if the transaction is not corrected, then it's still a prohibited transaction at the beginning of the following year, and it gets hit with another 15% penalty. So some of the years here got hit with a 60% penalty. In Rutland, for example, 89 TC 1137 back in 1987, the tax court held that taxpayers were liable for excise taxes on one prohibited transaction entered into on the date the loans were executed, plus an additional prohibited transaction on the first day of each taxable year or portion of a taxable year until that transaction was corrected. In Medina, 112 TC 51 in 1999, a prohibited transaction that consists of a loan may only be corrected by the repayment of principal plus reasonable interest. So the company, ESOP sponsor, as the disqualified person who participated in the transaction, must pay the excise tax, 15% of the amount involved imposed under 4975A, year after year after year after year. So at least on the earliest year, this could have been 60%. Now the IRS had a problem. They only had, they didn't go, they didn't have the statute open all the way back to 1999. They had 4 years for which the statute was open. So the maximum penalty would have been 60% of the transaction, but that's bad enough. We don't see the dollar amounts in the TAM. Next, final regulations on the waiting period for health insurance. TD 9671 on June the 25th, 2014, clarify that the maximum allowed length of any reasonable and bona fide employment-based orientation period to be consistent with the 90-day waiting period limitation can be no more than 30 days. Under the final regulations published back in February, a group health plan and a health insurance issuer offering group health insurance coverage may not apply any waiting period that exceeds 90 days. However, a waiting period is the period that must pass before coverage for an employee or dependent who is otherwise eligible to enroll. Being otherwise eligible to enroll means that the employee has met the substantive eligibility conditions, including satisfying a reasonable and bona fide employment-based orientation period. To prevent abuse and help everybody comply with the 90-day waiting period limitation, the new final regulations provide that 1 month is the maximum allowed length of any reasonable and bona fide employment-based orientation period. 1 month would be determined by adding one calendar month and subtracting one calendar day, measured from an employee's start date in a position that is otherwise eligible for coverage to the 90-day waiting period. So we finally have the guidance that we needed to determine how long an employee can be employed before they are required to be provided coverage. And that training period has to be a bona fide training period, by the way. It can't just be, you can't just say, well, everybody's going to have a 30-day training period. That's not necessarily the case. For those of us that monitor the IRS's disciplinary efforts, Electronic Communication 2014-25-012 on June the 6th, 2014, really sets us on edge. The IRS says a preparer penalty exam cannot be sent to appeals prior to the filing of the underlying return. However, an investigation may begin and the IRS may assess the penalty if the statute of limitations is about to expire and the taxpayer does not consent to extend the statute. While a preparer penalty will not generally be proposed until the exam is complete, and that's consistent with what the information that's in the Internal Revenue Manual, the Chief Counsel believes that if there is a delay in initiating a preparer penalty exam because of the length of time needed to complete the exam of the underlying return, that the IRS should open a preparer penalty case before the examination of the underlying return is complete. Next, and we should make short work of this one, Eric Onyango, 142 TC number 24, is not permitted to challenge his underlying tax liability based on his failure to receive a notice of deficiency when he simply didn't pick up his mail. He declined to accept delivery of a deficiency notice sent to him by certified mail by the Internal Revenue Service. Here's exactly what the court wrote, and we'll move on. We hold that petitioner may not decline to retrieve his Postal Service mail when he was reasonably able and had multiple opportunities to do so, and thereafter successfully contend that he did not receive, for purposes of Section 6330, print small c, 2b, the 2006-2007 notice of deficiency. So you can't game the system that way. You can't hide behind failing to pick up your mail. Next, Michael Agugo, TC Summary Opinion 2014-60, and his wife were not entitled to deduct expenses related to their insurance sales or home medical care activity because they did not prove that they were carrying on a trade or a business. We never get to Section 183 here. We don't get to Section 183 because the taxpayers had zero income from the purported insurance sales business, zero income from the purported home medical care activity. They did not get a license to even be engaged in the home medical care activity. So the court simply concluded that they didn't have to look at the support for the expenses, since even if the expenses were well supported, they were not deductible because they were not related to a trade or business in which the taxpayer was regularly engaged. Remember, there are two steps. to this, to claiming the trade or business deduction, you got to be in a trade or business, which is regular, continuous, substantial activity for the purpose of making a profit. And then you have to be able to support the reasonableness and the direct relationship of the expenses that are related to that activity. If you're not in a trade or business, we don't even have to discuss the support for your so-called deductions. Next, we have instructions for the Form 8938, the Statement of Specified Foreign Financial Assets for 2014. Taxpayers are now required to enter their calendar year or their fiscal year, beginning and ending dates, in the new entry spaces below the title of the form. We are directed to use Form 8938 to report our specified foreign financial assets, and you'll need to check the definition of those that's in the instructions. If the total value of all the specified foreign financial assets, and you need to put quotation marks around that because specified foreign financial assets are exactly that. They are the assets which are specified foreign financial assets in which you have an interest is more than the applicable reporting threshold, and the reporting thresholds are stated in the instructions. Filing Form 8938, remember, does not relieve you of the requirement to file the FinCEN Form 114, the Report of Foreign Bank and Financial Accounts, the so-called FBAR form. And if you're required to file the FBAR form, you want to see the instructions for Form 114 for those filing requirements. And many taxpayers are going to be required to file both. Filing one does not relieve you of the obligation to file the other. Next, Barbara Kupersmit, that's Kupersmit, TC Memo 2014-129 on June the 26th, got caught in a technical issue. The tax court, she gets an assessment for a later year. She's got uncashed refund checks from prior years. The year under consideration here is 2010. She had payments made in years before 2010. She had uncashed refund checks from 2008 and 2009, but those weren't applied to her 2010 tax liability. Now the question is, can she force the IRS to apply them by this action in tax court? And the tax court says, we have no jurisdiction to apply tax payments and uncashed refund checks from two prior years to reduce your individual tax deficiency for the 2010 tax year. When a tax liability comes before the court, the tax court is limited to the issue before it. And the issue before the tax court here was Mrs. Kupersmit's or Ms. Kupersmit's 2010 tax liability, not whether it had been satisfied, not whether it could be satisfied, but the amount of her liability. And the tax court had no authority to reach back into prior years or to consider Ms. Kupersmit's uncashed checks. I thought it was interesting from a technical point of view. Let me read two paragraphs from the court's opinion. Respondent, that would be the Internal Revenue Service, the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, has not determined a deficiency with respect to any year other than 2010. Generally, we may not decide whether an overpayment is present for any other year. As 2010 is the only year before the court, we lack jurisdiction to determine whether petitioner overpaid her taxes, that's Ms. Kupersmit, overpaid her taxes for any prior year, and we also lack jurisdiction to apply any such overpayment against her 2010 deficiency. The court goes on to cite several cases in which it has ruled similarly to this one. Even if the 2008 and 2009 payments and uncashed refund checks were overpayments of tax due, the commissioner has no obligation to apply payments from prior years for tax year 2010. The court goes on, we lack jurisdiction to determine that the payments the taxpayer made in 2008 and 2009 and the uncashed refund checks were overpayments and therefore do not apply any such amounts against the taxpayer's deficiency in tax for 2010. That leaves us with just one item, and that is announcement of the Voluntary Return Preparer Education Program. It is, according to the Commissioner John Koskinen, a temporary solution until Congress gives the IRS the authority for mandatory oversight of return preparers. A return preparer who wants to participate in the program will have to be registered with the Internal Revenue Service, have a valid preparer tax ID number, meet some continuing education requirements, and pass an exam. The IRS expects the program to be in place by the beginning of the 2015 filing season, and CPAs and enrolled agents all over the country are going nuts. Why? Well, because these minimal requirements that would be imposed on a voluntary return preparer will allow the voluntary return preparer to be listed in a national database of those return preparers who have maintained a professional standard and upon whose skill a taxpayer may rely. And they're going to be in the same list with enrolled agents and certified public accountants. But the education requirements and the testing requirements are going to be substantially less. So we'll have to see how this one plays out. I personally favor some sort of a process of vetting who can be permitted to prepare federal income tax returns. I think that whole industry has gotten pretty sloppy, but I'm not sure that we have the right answer yet. Well, that's a wrap for this week, and remember, stay safe. Next week,